Well, good morning, everyone. We're very excited about having you here at our town hall meeting to talk about prevention and the Health Promotion Council's plan that's going to roll out next spring. Let me put a little background for you on how I see this council and its report. And the importance to the health of our nation. You know, we've always had this dream. You know, I kind of say, you know, wouldn't it be nice if the President of the United States stood up and said that the nation, you know, we should be the healthiest nation on the world, you know. And I've always argued we ought to do that in a generation. And, I mean, you actually heard that, those of you who were at the Health Summit, actually heard that sentiment expressed by our Surgeon General. You know, we've always talked about the fact that, you know, if something happens to you, you get sick, the U.S. is where you want to be. There's no question about that. Now, it's better to be in the U.S. and get sick and have a, you know, an insurance card, you know, a good insurance card. But even if you don't have an insurance card, you know, you often do, of course, better than other places on the planet if something happens to you. However, in terms of just broad quality of life and quality of health, as a population, from a population perspective, we are certainly not getting the value for the amount of money we put on the table, nor, as a society, the value that we believe we deserve. So having very senior leadership get up and say that this is an important component of their political, legislative, or management agenda, I think is a very, very important statement. So has that happened? Well, in essence, yes. The President of the United States has pulled his cabinet together and said, listen, you know, health is very important. It's an important part of our national priority. And I want all of you members of the cabinet to work and play well together and to think about health and everything that you do. And, you know, those of you would recognize that as, in essence, a health in all policies concept. So the president has clearly provided leadership. And then, of course, a very wise man, he turns to his wife, Michelle, and asked Michelle to basically lead the nation and focusing that effort on our children. And her Let's Move campaign is an effort to actually do that. And if you think about the leading causes of death, and then those of you who are obviously very much involved in social determinants and understanding what actually kills people in our country, it's, you know, physical inactivity, diet, and tobacco. And that if we wanted to take one big bite out of the leading causes of death, and in many cases disability, we could focus on those three things and we can make quantum leaps in the improvement of health of our nation. Well, then we get legislation passed. Well, there was a big national vigorous debate around coverage. And while they were vigorously debating around coverage, we were all quietly slipping in pieces around prevention and wellness, which did not get the kind of coverage that, that's fine, that one would like, but it also means that most of the people in the public health community don't have a clue what's in the legislation. Well, what's important, and one of the things that's in the legislation, is that a national council was formed, headed by the Surgeon General. Now, many of you know the Surgeon General frankly had two jobs. One had the bully pulpit as the nation's top promoter of health promotion disease prevention. And the second job the Surgeon General had was to lead, you know, the 6,500 member commission corps. And those are wonderful, wonderful jobs. But other than the bully pulpit and a wonderful uniform and leadership role, as you know, the Surgeon General doesn't have much of a budget, and so reports come out based on what you know the Surgeon General can craft as an agenda and who's doing studies within HHS, and a range of other complicated things, which decide, you know, how the Surgeon General can engage the public. However, now the Surgeon General really has a real mechanism to do that task of being the nation's health promoter and disease preventer. Surgeon General leads this council of members of the President's cabinet. Okay? And so the President now has a mechanism to, in effect, define at the broadest way how we're going to improve the health and well-being of America. So imagine now, some of you may have seen the story in the New York Times the other day about how we're obviously trying to promote our health on one side and selling lots of cheese on the other. Well, I can't tell you that's not going to happen, but it is much likely that somebody in the Ag Department would say, you know, should we be doing this? And how can we do this in a more proactive manner? And as we're doing the, deciding on the nutritional content for school lunches, it makes it much more likely that someone in that department is also going to be asking those important questions. It makes it much more likely they'll pick up the phone because they know one another, and they kind of have some concept of what the national agenda is, and coordinate that. Now, by the way, that worked fairly well with terrorism and pan flu, when we had a national focus on everybody getting involved. So imagine the Treasury Department thinking about how they can use tax incentives to move small community stores from selling, you know, high caloric, high fat content foods to serving more nutritious, affordable fresh fruits and vegetables, and trying to use tax policy to do that. But they have to decide that that's in the national interest, and that people can make money doing that, and figure out ways to do that on some kind of blueprint. So the idea is that certainly this council, which of course will put out an annual report headed by the Surgeon General, they have put out at least their first report, which was basically just a blueprint on how they're going to begin to approach the process. But now what they're doing is they put some ideas out that, by the way, these are straw ideas. These are really straw man ideas. But they're really interested in hearing from us out in the field about what we think. What do we think is important? And how do they think we need to proceed? And of course, this report will be done by the end of the year, and then it's got to go through all the myriad clearances, and I'll let our speakers tell you all the details about that. But it is on a short timeline. They've been kind enough to come here today to talk about this with us, to seek our support and guidance. I know it's early in the morning. I know many of you may not be able to stay for the whole thing, but please, this is a town hall meeting. This is supposed to be a discussion. Normally, those of you senior leaders who have come to this breakfast in the past know that my usual unhealthy food is served. I didn't think it would be a good role model this morning. So even I am eating bran muffins this morning. But there's lots of it, and so we want to encourage you to eat and partake of nutritious foods and give us your best thoughts. With us this morning, we have Janet Collins. Dr. Collins is Associate Director for Program at the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, and Andrew Ryan, who's the Associate Director for Policy at the CDC. They are staffing and supporting this effort on the part of the Surgeon General and the Department of Health and Human Services. And with no further ado, I will turn it over to Mr. Ryan. Andy. Thanks a lot.
Well, it's great to be, hold on one second, I'll grab my water, because that's a healthy drink to drink. Also, I do have my juice, but I haven't checked the caloric content. No, thank you very much. It's great to be among friends, and I think I sat down with George's could have been April, beginning of May, and I said, you know, we're working on this with Surgeon General Gina Benjamin, and we're going to need a lot of help. We're going to need a lot of input. I don't really know the plan, but can you save us a space at the conference? And he was generous enough to do it, and then it worked out, and here we are today. So today we're going to talk, Janet and I, about the council and the strategy and give you an overview. But it really is an opportunity to hear from you what you've been thinking. There's information on the website. Many of you have looked at this, and we really want to hear what's going on. We, I, and I'm sure Janet discloses that we have no relationships to disclose. I think I've done my appropriate duty there. So as Dr. Benjamin said, and I have two Dr. Benjamins who I cherish these times.
No relationship.
And as long as I don't email, get confused when I type into Outlook, I think we're all doing okay. We've all done this. We can raise our hands later. We've heard a lot about the Affordable Care Act. We've heard a lot about coverage, 32 million additional people. That's wonderful. People with coverage get more care, get better care, are healthier. There is a national quality strategy, and there are other activities within the Affordable Care Act to increase quality. Obviously, getting care is, having coverage is one thing. Getting to the doctor is another. Getting the doctor and working with the doctor to do the right things, quality, doctor, hospital, that's very important. Cost, obviously, we spend a huge amount of our GDP compared to most nations on healthcare, and the results we have are not what they should be. So there are many activities within the Affordable Care Act to control cost, but it really is an opportunity for prevention, and I think you're exactly right that many of these things have gotten lost in the debate, and I'll highlight them for a few seconds here so that we don't lose them again. But I think of them, we think of them in really, you know, four pillars of prevention. Key preventive services, these are U.S. Preventive Services Task Force A&B recommendations, ACIP recommendations, are now going to be covered without cost sharing for non-grandfathered plans. A tremendous benefit. There's the Prevention Public Health Fund we'll get into. There are certain programs, and then what we're here to talk today about the council and the strategy. As I mentioned, people will be able to go to their, have coverage in their insurance plan and go to their doctor and not have cost sharing as a obstacle for, you know, key preventive screenings, A&B task force screenings, whether it be cholesterol, blood pressure, certain cancer screenings. It's really a great benefit to reduce that obstacle. As I mentioned before, focusing on quality of those services. The Prevention and Public Health Fund. Many of us in this room and others have fought for years to have a dedicated funding stream, especially for chronic diseases, but to fund prevention and public health, and it was through the great work of many and our friends on the Hill and the President signed, in the law, a fund growing, already appropriated from $500 million last year to $2 billion annually from 2015 to 2019, $2 billion annually. It is a great resource. It is what many of us have fought for so long. As we know, these are tight fiscal times, and there are, you know, people on the Hill for a variety of reasons looking for funds, you know, to offset, to do, you know, all sorts of different programs, whether it be changing the Affordable Care Act or something else. This is an incredibly important fund. It is incredibly productive already. Money went out the door this year, obviously, for primary care workforce, for community clinical prevention, public health infrastructure. $191 million came from the CDC to really fund mostly states and localities for infrastructure. Communities putting prevention to work grants, HIV, a lot of good programs come out of this. We, of course, want to sustain this so that we can support state and local and community public health into the future. It is very important and a great opportunity. And in terms of sustaining it, I get calls all the time, well, this is under attack, what should we do? And this isn't a political speech, it's a substantive speech, which is we all need to do prevention really well and communicate the effect we have. We can't be saying, oh, you can't measure what we do. We really have to show the world that prevention works, prevention sells. All the polling we've all seen says prevention is a great word. It's got bipartisan support, but we have to back it up with our actions and our communications. We do with our actions every day. We need to, again, communicate the benefits of prevention all the time, and that will be what promotes prevention and keeps it alive. As I mentioned, public health programs and policies funded in the Act, home visiting programs, community health center expansion to maybe 40 million people getting preventive services in their neighborhoods.
Medicare wellness visit, these are just selected examples. Medicare beneficiaries starting crossing that certain age, having a wellness visit, and menu labeling, which we will see in the near future, and those of us who live in communities that have menu labeling see the benefits and hear the conversations and the calorie consciousness as someone orders their, you know, frappuccino and muffin and realizes between breakfast and lunch they're consuming 752 calories. But that brings us to the fourth pillar in what we're here to talk about today, which is the Council and the National Prevention Strategy, as I mentioned, established by the Affordable Care Act. It really is a unique opportunity to prioritize and align prevention activities. There are many departments across the federal government who are concerned about health, have health promotion in their policies, but this is such a great opportunity to have this council working together to align and prioritize those activities, as George has said. Cabinet-level officials getting together to do this. Chaired, as I said, by Regina Benjamin, the Surgeon General. 17 federal departments, 5 were added since the law was enacted to make sure we had as much inclusion as possible and departments really working together. And there is an advisory group to be named, projected by the end of the year, of not more than 25 non-federal members who will also contribute to not only the strategy but the ongoing work of the council. As I mentioned, 17 departments, and just to give a little sense of the opportunities here, working together as we look, and I won't read them all, but as we sit around the table, obviously Health and Human Services is working on prevention all the time, but Department of Agriculture, having DOD, Department of Defense, a huge healthcare delivery system, education at the table, housing, healthy housing, transportation, labor, Veterans Affairs, obviously a huge health delivery system as well. EPA, it's been wonderful to sit down with our colleagues at the EPA with the input they've had saying, hold on, here's what affects health from the environmental point of view. Don't just think about it in the traditional public health sense. It's been a really wonderful experience. Federal Trade Commission, in terms of our advertising to our children, so many great opportunities. And I certainly recommend to you to read the National Drug Control Policy, which is really prevention-oriented, really forward-thinking. Great opportunities to get everyone together. So let's just go back for a quick second. I think you mentioned a health and all policies approach, and you know, it's great as we go out and listen. People are like, why aren't you saying it's health and all policies? And some people are saying, what is this health and all policies? I don't get it. The language, depending what group you're talking to. But as we work together with all these councils in all their activities, whether it be policy, regulatory, their grant programs, it really is a manifestation of that work every day on the ground that we have the potential to actualize. So according to the law, there are deliverables for the National Council, and I just outlined them here to keep us all in check. There is a National Prevention Strategy due March 23rd, the anniversary of the Act, 2011. The Council is also designated to provide ongoing leadership and coordination of federal prevention activities. So the Council does not stop March 23rd. It goes on, and that's one of the real potentials. And I plant that seed if you have some feedback on how the Council can really play that role on an ongoing basis. And an annual status report due July 1st every year through 2015. As you know, we put one out, the Surgeon General and the Council put one out on June 30th, one day ahead of schedule, always good to be timely. This year, and it really did set out some of the blueprint and some of our core guiding principles, and Janet will talk about that in a second. And of course, the Affordable Care Act says that after obtaining input from relevant stakeholders, the Council should develop national prevention health promotion strategy, and I just say that because here's where we are, and this is the time to really discuss what we're doing. And this is one of a number of national conferences that we have been speaking at, will be speaking at. Outreach calls, the Surgeon General has hosted a couple, and there will be more to come. There will be HHS regional meetings in all the HHS regions, and trying to work with the other members of the council to bring in their constituents at the local level. And there's also the council website, that's healthcare.gov/National Prevention Council. Healthcare.gov, did I mention that? /National Prevention Council. People can go on the website and provide input on the national strategy generally or the framework that Janet will talk about specifically, and that will keep on rolling out so we can get more feedback. But I also want to use this opportunity very quickly to ask all of you to assist. You're all here, you're obviously interested, have something to say, and it's great to see our friends here. But we all need, also need to reach out to other friends who didn't have the opportunity to be here and across sectors. We really want to reach out and bring people and say, there is going to be a national prevention strategy. The federal government wants to hear from you. This is your opportunity. We do want to hear from everyone. So I ask you, there's a stakeholder outreach kit so that any of you could host your own meetings and provide stakeholder input. You can reach out and have other people do it. We really want to do it, so I encourage that, especially across sectors. So that's the council and the input. Bringing us to the strategy, it is going to ground activities in evidence-based practices. I can't express how important this is. We've all worked on many different programs or many different colleagues, and we see there are things that work and things that don't work as well, and some things don't work at all. We really need to ground it in the evidence, and one of the forward very important pieces of the law is saying that the federal government activities within and outside HHS should be grounded in the evidence base. It's very important. There are limited resources for prevention. We need to focus them on things that work. The strategy will set specific actions and timelines. It will align and focus federal prevention and health promotion activities, as I've said. And just as I mentioned this, align, that means if we're all working on the same thing, we will have more impact than doing 1,000 things. And I think Dr. Benjamin also talked about focusing on the leading causes of death. It is really important to focus to have greatest impact. There are a lot of different priorities out there that really affect a lot of people. There's no question about that. But if we can focus and align federal activities and our partner activities, we can have more impact. And we need to align with existing strategies and initiatives. There are many of them. We know reports come out all the time. There's lots of good stuff. We need to bring those together and align with them. And I'd say almost most important is Healthy People 2020, and we've had a lot of conversation with how is the national strategy, national prevention strategy, going to work with healthy people? And I want to think about it in two ways with you. One is alignment of priorities. We're going to be working towards the same goals, those healthy people priority goals and objectives and indicators. And they're also complementary. Healthy People provides us all a tool in our public health practice to look at what is important, what are the goals over time, all the indicators that people have thought through, both data sources and validity and the importance. So it really provides us that great tool every day. The National Prevention Strategy will align and focus specific activities of the federal government and with our public and private partners to really make progress on especially leading causes of death that are affecting large parts of the population. Obviously, the National Quality Strategy, hand in glove, quality and prevention. As we align those, it's very important. First Lady's Let's Move campaign, Surgeon General's Vision for a Healthy and Fit Nation, National HIV Strategy, this is just a few of them. But there are a lot of really good plans coming out of the federal government. The strategy will be aligned with all of them. And as I mentioned, working across sectors, it really is that opportunity. And I will say from a professional, personal point of view, the joy and the real benefits we've had of working with 17 federal departments and hearing the input and enthusiasm of senior government officials wanting to say, hey, how can we work together? How can we do prevention? Sure, I'm transportation and I need to efficiently move people from here to there and worry about energy. But in transportation, there is so many opportunities to build in active design, to encourage physical activity. How can we work together to do that? It's really a great opportunity. Catalyzing public and private partnerships, federal, state, local level, our nonprofit, our community, our private healthcare sector, there are partners in faith, business, labor that we want to work together with because that's the way we can have maximum impact. And also, to maximize impact, we need to focus on where people live, learn, work, and play. And we also need to prioritize scalable activities. There are actually, going back to the evidence base, there are evidence-based programs that are narrow. If we're going to really have a big impact, we need scalability. And a lot of those are policy and system changes that really affect the environment. And Janet will probably talk a little more about those. And with that, as I said, Janet's going to talk about them. She'll talk about them now. Thanks a lot.
Well, good morning. It's fabulous to see such a great turnout, your interest and your participation this morning. We're getting closer to the time that you're going to be put to work here. What I'm going to do is cover sort of a little bit about where our thinking has been, where it's evolved to, but it really is quite developmental, and this is a really important period of time to get your input on the direction and development of the strategy. We started with our first annual release of the council last July with guiding principles for the development of this strategy. The call for the strategy came into being in March, and by July we were having to provide an annual report on how we were doing with the strategy, which was a bit daunting, but there's almost nothing that isn't daunting about the assignment of ahead. Thank goodness we have Andrew Ryan. I just so appreciate your enthusiasm and he just has such tremendous energy for this. It's a joy to work with you, Andrew. So we started with the guiding principles, and I'll go over them very briefly. There were nine. I hope many of you saw them on the website during the release of the first annual report of the work on this strategy. Prioritizing prevention and wellness, and by that it was clearly meant that we would be working as far upstream as we possibly can to be focused on maintaining health in the first place and really focused on prevention, wellness, health, again, as far upstream as possible. Promoting health equity, a core principle for this work, and really an exciting part of this work is to think about that cross-sector approach that's enabled by the engagement of these 17 federal agencies and to think about sort of the foundation for many of the health inequities in this country is really stemming from some of these core issues around employment and housing, education, justice issues. So, you know, in some ways, for the first time, we have the opportunity to be with all these sectors engaged to really look at some of the core foundational causes of health inequity in this country. Ensuring accountability. This is not a report that we can afford to have put on the shelves once developed. We're going to need not only accountability, we're going to need engagement. And really want to talk to you about how do we engage at all levels, at neighborhoods, communities, states, nationally. Obviously, the federal government will be engaged, but we need engagement and accountability for delivery on the national strategy as it comes into place. Continuing with the guiding principles, Andrew focused on the leading causes of death. Again, this strategy, perhaps unlike 2020, will not be the entire arena of all that might be done, but will be a focused one on those strategies and those priorities that are going to have the largest impact on health in the country. We want to focus on high impact, evidence-based and scalable interventions. Other than the prevention fund that we're incredibly excited about in terms of base funding for public health, there's not anticipated in this economic environment large influxes of resources to public health, although obviously I congratulate the advocates to continue the press for the kinds of resources that are needed to address these issues. But we're really having to think about a strategy that can be activated with current resources and in ways that are sustainable over time. And oftentimes that does mean policy interventions that once established can really serve health for generations to come. We want to promote high-value preventive care practices, very consistent with the Affordable Care Act. And finally, the last three guiding principles, a cohesive federal response. Again, such a unique opportunity to have these federal agencies sitting at the same table. And the council is made up of the cabinet secretaries, so it's at the very highest level. They are the authors of this report, and they are committing their agencies to the work of this report. So a very historic opportunity, really, for us. Promoting alignment between the public and private sectors. Notice that this is a national strategy, not a federal strategy. To be a national strategy, then, we really need engagement of private, public institutions, businesses, schools, the federal government, and so on. And obtaining stakeholder input was an early guiding principle as we headed into the development of this report. So the council has established kind of a scaffold, which we call the framework. It's made up of a draft vision, draft goals, and some draft strategic directions. This is in flux, not even soft concrete. This is the perfect opportunity now for you to give input on this framework, because the next step will be the development of specific recommendations and action items that will build out from this framework. So we need to get the framework right, and then we need to dive deeper and build out the recommendations and the action items that will actually drive action in this country. So right now we have this draft framework, and we're seeking your input about that, as well as your input about recommendations and action items to follow. The draft vision then, working together to improve the health and quality of life for individuals, families, and communities by moving the nation from a focus on sickness and disease to one based on wellness and prevention. Our draft goals, I think we're pretty agreed, the words aren't quite right here, and we actually may need a couple more draft goals, but seeking your reaction and thoughts about our draft goals, they include creating community environments that make the healthy choice the easy and affordable choice. And so this is really, you know, looking at what are those policies, what are those social, physical, and economic environments that can be created and sustained to give equal opportunity for health in this country. And then promoting effective preventive practices. And here we mean not only the clinical preventive practices that we've discussed, but the community preventive activities like cessation programs, like the diabetes prevention program, like, you know, community-based service delivery that in fact can be linked to those clinical preventive activities in a more comprehensive system. And then the draft strategic directions, 10 of them as they now stand, and really needing to layer onto this list the whole structure for this strategy being that we're trying to impact community systems. So when we're looking at activity, when we're looking at healthy eating, when we're looking at injury-free living, we're really talking about the built environment, the social environment. Is there access to healthy and affordable foods? Is there equitable ability to have safe parks and safe streets to be active and to play? So those are the 10 strategic directions that are the current focus of the framework. These strategic directions then form that structure from which we will develop specific recommendations and actions. They establish priorities to prevent the leading causes of death and disability. They underpin some of the most important levers that we have for health promotion. And the strategic directions will serve as a guide to policymakers, practitioners, and communities. As Andrew mentioned, sort of getting everybody from local up through federal aligned and focused so that the actions are complementary and can, you know, really best achieve outcome. So effective interventions that will be considered across the strategic directions, of course, include policy, system change, environmental change, communication and media work, and program and service delivery. So since this framework was presented, we've been in a number of town hall situations. We've been getting input from across the country, and some themes are sort of coming up repeatedly. I thought I'd just briefly share those, and then we'll move to the participation part of the morning. That we should do a better job across all of the framework in highlighting the importance of the cross-sector approach, with the overarching goals then being that all sectors working together to support health and wellness where people live, learn, work, and play, using again that prevention lens, the maintenance of health in the first place in all that we do, integrating the healthcare and community efforts into a seamless whole, and empowering and educating consumers to demand healthy choices. These themes have come out of stakeholder meetings as well as council meetings. And so this morning, we welcome you, and we're going to open now the floor for your advice and your comments. And we actually welcome you to speak to anything that we've presented, general recommendations, thoughts about the draft framework, or if you want to even dig down further and speak to things that you feel would be critical recommendations to appear in this report, we welcome your comments on any and all of that. I'll leave this slide up just to help you sort of remember some of the content that's being discussed. And I think Andrew's mic'd here, and we, we're going to use the microphone, and we're happy to answer additional questions, but what frankly we prefer to hear is your advice and the direction you believe we should head with this. Wonderful. Welcome.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, yeah.
I want to highlight just sort of four quick points that were mentioned a little bit in our meeting on Saturday with you, but sort of overall approach specifically. One is the aspect of integration, which is what this whole model is about, and to consider to look at other countries, because those countries, of course, they have a very different health system, but in the sense of how they infuse health in their environments, in their community, how do they do it? What strategies they use at the state, at the local level, the regional level, et cetera, and model some of that, and I think there would be a lot of lessons learned. One of the questions that came up with our group also is, how can you model the national collaboration across sectors at the state and local level, which includes, of course, the private sector and not just the government sector? What ways can this strategy, and if there are possible resources, to help state and local governments, not just public health, but healthcare, but also all the other aspects of governments, as you're modeling at the federal level, national level, how can that help the infrastructure at the state and local level to do the same type of collaboration? Another key point that affects all of these is the issue of health literacy, and that's for everyone. How does it, and part of this is communication. How does this get translated to people that are outside the health sector, which is the same issue with healthy people, to make that into strategies using social networking, et cetera, and other opportunities? So those are the key concepts I'd like to share.
Thank you. That's fantastic. And I'll just make mention that this table up front is taking avid notes about all of the recommendations, but I also would just say back to you a little bit of a challenge to say, those of you at the state and local level, if you can advise us about how this could help in that modeling and that promotion of the integration at multiple levels, would very much appreciate concrete suggestions about how to make that a reality.
Thank you. I was gonna say exactly the same thing, because it is, in a certain sense, all of our strategy. So those are great questions. We love the input.
Hi, my name is Lori Stillman, and I'm with a nonprofit organization in Boston called Health Resources in Action. In the 20 years that I've been coming to this meeting, it's just been so exciting to see such an alignment on prevention-oriented issues and health equity issues as it is in this meeting. It's just very exciting. And so is this prevention strategy, just wonderful. There's one area that did strike me, however, that seemed a little bit weak, and that is around occupational health and safety. I saw it mentioned once under injury-free living, but one of the things that we do is pull together the CDC asthma managers and the different states, and we pull together our BRFSS data and saw, it just jumped out at us, how many people with asthma say that they've had to change their jobs because of the toxins or the exposures that they face in their workplace. Up to 20% and even more low-income workers have to change their jobs because of the environmental exposure. So I would like to just make the recommendation that under healthy physical and social environments, where you only focus really on the community, that you add a bullet workplace environments as well.
Excellent. Thank you.
I think that's excellent, and it also reminds me how great it is to have, obviously, NIOSH, the CDC, and the Department of Labor at the table, you know, together.
Hi, Tony. I'm from California Endowment. We're in the process of, in California, putting basically $1 billion bet on community transformation over the next 10 years that we can actually affect key measures of health more effectively through changing policies and systems at the community level. And so in the process of that, we're learning a few things. And one of the things that I think is really important is the whole idea of this work being about changing social norms. Mm-hmm. And then the need for developing a new narrative around health. And the federal government can be very helpful to us around that, not by quickly pushing out a new narrative around health. And this is the beginning of that, but it needs an affirmative message going out about why this is important, how health is broader than health care, and to try to change people's consciousness about how they can be involved in the process of improving health in the community. The second thing that's particularly important for us to be able to communicate is the how of this work. And I think that this is a suggestion for maybe another category, somewhere beneath the mission and goals, talking about the approach. And you listed policy and systems change, bring, you know, all the way down to a whole series of different ways of doing it. But there needs to be some sort of synthesis of the how, a statement about, and how this work is not traditional work. This work is really about looking at policies, looking at systems and the implementation of policies and practices all the way down to the community level, and then trying to develop some local and community level accountability for the implementation and maintenance of these policy and systems changes. So people read this and they think, well, this sounds great, but how do we do it? And it would be great to have the federal government sort of standing up there and saying, we believe that the approach that needs to be taken, or amongst the approaches that need to be taken, there needs to be focus on policy, systems change, and, you know, all this interdisciplinary work, as well as deep and meaningful community participatory practices, particularly with high or low-income communities.
Thank you. That narrative is extremely helpful, and I read on the plane out here your draft Health and All Policies Plan for California. I don't know if that is the plan that underpins the community transformation work, but I was very, very impressed with that draft, and I just saw enormous complementary thinking, I guess, going on between that and this. But you're quite right, and the how as operationalized not only in that narrative but in the recommendations and action items that are determined is going to be very, very key. And we have such a short amount of time to pull that all together. And it's going to be important that this document be somewhat of a living document so that if we get it 80% right, maybe that's wishful thinking, that it really is thought to evolve over time to really capture the how. And especially as we learn the how in some locations that are ahead of others and really use those as models for other communities. So thank you for those comments.
And I just want to add, in terms of the positive, proactive message, I have to, you know, admire Regina Benjamin, you know, Surgeon General, who will wrap my knuckles, you know, every time we talk about it. Stop talking about preventing disease and start talking about creating something and moving positive. And I think it's really important. Yes, we're trying to prevent people from premature death, prevent disease. That's all true. But in terms of promoting, creating, catalyzing, those kind of parts of the narrative are very important for people not to see the public health community as, you know, why are you telling me no, no, no? Tell me what we can do.
Susan Woolley, I'm the Executive Director of the American School Health Association. I really applaud the direction that this is going and the cross-sectional approach, realizing that if we have to go way beyond what just the health agencies, health departments can do, education is about 25% of the population when you get all the children and all the people that workforce in schools. One of the things that you might consider when you talked about accountability is making sure that they're interfacing with various accountability systems. So for instance, as Elementary and Secondary Education Act is being reauthorized, that one of the things that's going to be in there is, again, is a strong sense of accountability. And so that we're getting measures, as we're getting measures and setting up large systems for accountability, that we're making sure that we're not creating parallel systems, but somehow as we're in the creation of those systems, we're doing them synergistically so that we're not putting an undue burden on those collecting the data. And if we don't, as you said, if we don't have the accountability 10 years from now, we may have done a great job, but it's very hard to show what didn't happen in terms of prevention and health promotion. Another point is that as you're ramping up, it's great that there are like 25 non-government agency people that are going to be in the council and federal agencies, but obviously there's a lot more involved in out there. And whether there's any possibility of doing some kind of tiering so that you have this group and then they in turn have cluster groups underneath of them. Just as an example, in the school health field, I recently convened from 17 federal agencies and 35 national organizations just around the issues related to what's happening in schools.
I think that's, they're all excellent points. Before I was in health, I was designing accountability systems for schools and trying to build these things, and that's a challenge, trying to read, write, and be active and all those things. But I will also say one of the pieces in the law says that the council should be devising, I can't quote the exact words, a ongoing stakeholder input process. So I think it's both in the law, and your suggestion is very well taken in terms of how to keep this kind of stakeholder input process and maybe more structured alive and ongoing.
Good morning. I'm Marilyn Rice from the American Health Organization. I want to thank you so much for inviting us to be here. First of all, I'd like to commend you on this enormous effort and how broadly you're casting the net in terms of creating conditions for people to be healthy. I think it's a wonderful change of focus, and I think it's going to really move us ahead as a country. A couple of points I wanted to make that maybe get scratching beneath the surface on some of these things. We talk about eliminating the health disparities, and I think it's really important to be able to find ways of identifying the gradients across all population groups. And I think that requires really coming up with systems of being able to collect data that can identify that gradient. And it goes beyond just looking at individual factors like age, sex, race, et cetera. So I think that's one of our challenges, and if you really want to look at the gradient, we're going to need to find ways of identifying where those populations are. Secondly, I wanted to talk about, just on the policy level, I'm thrilled with the long list of agencies you have working collaboratively on this, and it really is getting at the issue of health and all policies, intersectoral collaboration, et cetera, et cetera. I'd like to propose, if it's not in the details, that we think about incorporating health impact assessments in the work that all of those agencies are doing, so that it becomes part of their mandate, part of the work that they do from the national level, trickling on down to the local level. Secondly, I'd like to talk about how to deal with the mobile populations. You have a section that talks about getting people where they live, work, play, et cetera. And I think we need to recognize we're doing a lot of work in Poland looking at the whole issue of urban health and how do we deal with urban populations. The populations are mobile. They don't necessarily live near where they work. Maybe they're working out of their house. Maybe they're working all over the country, all over the world. Maybe they're working today in one place and living there, and the next year they're living somewhere else. So to look at how can we really follow populations in a more mobile way rather than thinking that they're going to come always to the same practitioner and the same health services. And that's a real challenge I think we have in terms of urbanization and localization. Lastly, I wanted to address the whole issue of going to scale with successful experiences. And I think one of the key things, and this is what we're struggling with in the Americas, one of the key things that really helps us to replicate experiences and find out why they're successful is to document the context. Not just what happened, but why it happened and how it happened. Because we want to repeat that. It's not just a recipe of saying that we did X, Y, and Z, but how do we do it, who collaborated, why was it successful? We're trying to come up with instruments in Pothole to help countries document experiences in terms of what happened in the context that made it successful. So I want to suggest that as one of the elements in terms of going to scale. Thank you.
That's great, and I just want to mention one section of the law talks about standardizing health disparities data. So legally, there's a process already in place to do that. On the other side, there's more to be done in terms of sexual orientation, and we know that the rural issues are different than the urban issues and all these things. So lots of important ways to both standardize, slice the data, and also look in different contexts that people live, work, and play, and move. I think that's great.
Good morning. I'm Bobby Chapman. Local Metro Department of Culture and Women, Executive Board in Guam, Florida, in 2 weeks. I'm going to start with a very specific thing that goes to the more general. As a local health officer for the last 15 years, I'm very excited about the direction, but there's also a recognition amongst our colleagues that there's a possibility this could actually erode the work and the structure and support for local public health. A lot of the work that the health departments have done around prevention and can, under the new legislation, in some sense, can be carried on by local practitioners and offices or FUACs, and the possibility of eroding the support of local public health is actually there. So that piece, number nine, becomes particularly important in strategizing how to strengthen local public health and state public health as well, since all health is local as far as we're concerned. That's the more specific comment. In a more general sense, the research suggests that the nationhood have the healthiest populations are the most egalitarian, not the richest. And consequently, there's an issue around WHO's suggestion that if we want to really fix this problem, one of the things we have to do is address the inequitable distribution of power, wealth, and resources. And in the context of 17 federal agencies talking about this issue, I'm wondering how that's going to be absorbed or be addressed in the overall context of really making a difference in changing the landscape of health inequities in this country. I guess the last piece is we still have this issue of language and what we're going to call this. In the overarching principle, we talk about health equity. In the strategic direction, we talk about eliminating health disparities. And I recognize that's an ongoing issue that we're all struggling with, but it still has to be addressed. And the young lady who mentioned creating health equity has always been our call at NATO. So those are my comments.
Thank you. Excellent.
And we've been having discussions about, let's use education, for example. That some of the most important things the Department of Education can do for health and education departments can do for health is educate our kids really well. So labor, same issue. So when I think about the wealth inequalities and labor market and all these things, part of how we've been thinking about it more and more in our mind is all these departments, one of the things, they have to do what they do well, and they have to think about health within it. I think the National Prevention Strategy, if it tried to solve every problem, we wouldn't know how to do it. We'd get so diffused that we wouldn't get anywhere. But the beauty of all these council members, they need to do their jobs well, their mission, and think about health within it. And someone must have read my email about health impact assessment just the other day that I sent to Janet. I know it's all public, but it's those kind of things. Do your job well, think about the health impacts, and do it. So I think these are great comments.
Hi, Rob Gould, Partnership for Prevention, and I read it too, so I'm just going to put in, yes, health impact assessments, I vote for that too. It's always good to go in the middle, so when everyone said a lot of smart things that you were going to say, but it was in the context of a couple of other comments, so I'll go back to it. One is that there's really good news. The good news is that I agree that we really have to get the public on our side. We need to get the public center. The good news is that, as you said, Andrew, the polling shows are on our side, but the recent polling shows that even when it's tested, it's not just do you support prevention in the community, but when it's tested on, when counter-arguments are made, when taxes are included, and would you willing to pay taxes, it still survives. And even better, it survives at the end of the survey, after all is said and done, the strength of public support for what we're doing increases. And the core idea that it's a community responsibility to get help and not just an individual responsibility. We need to grab that. And I believe we need to do a national campaign, not just to educate the public about what the social determinants model is, but to get them to understand that they have a responsibility to demand help in their community. And by that way, we develop a kind of grassroots that's not just us, it's the public. On this, I'm reminded of the challenge of organizing this national prevention strategy across all of the federal government sectors. When I read the book, I don't know if you've read the book or anyone here, the book by the Heath brothers on switch, how to get change to occur. Okay, and it's talking about moving the elephant, and that's what it makes me think of. How do you move the elephant? The two things that advice in the book are shrink the change and guide the path. And on shrink the change, I really like what you were saying earlier about the enthusiasm that some of the folks in the other sectors are showing for this. Reward them for that enthusiasm immediately and show what they're already doing in other area sectors and demonstrate how what they're doing already is having an impact, a positive impact behind the strategy of dementia prevention strategy, and so we need to get momentum behind support for it, because it can be threatened. All of this investment can be threatened. So we really need to have one overarching goal that we can constantly know that we're going to reach and brag about. And I believe if you pick all of those issues, if we all put some emphasis on tobacco, I just believe that's the issue where if we set a goal to lower prevalence to below 10% in the next 10 years, we can show just what we can do to get brought to our lives. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Geraldine Simpkins. I'm the Executive Director of the Midwives Alliance of North America. Thank you for this excellent plan on prevention. And you mentioned early on that as part of your overall vision is to start furthest upstream when we think about prevention. Now, of course, we all speak from our own world vision, but that means to me we start at preconception and birth, and particularly labor and delivery. And most of us in this room are aware that we have an epidemic of preterm birth and premature babies. And when you have premature babies, you're going to have children with problems, you're going to have teenagers with problems, you're going to have adults that die early. So I think we need to start at the very beginning, which to me is birth. And I don't actually see too much reflected up here in terms of maternal child health. And we know that statement, if mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. And I wanted to, in case you weren't aware, I wanted to make you aware of a couple of really important studies in the last couple of years. The Milbank Foundation, the Reforming States Group, and the Childhood Connection Group put together, had a look at the maternity care system in the United States recently, a very critical look. And among the things that they found was that we have the most expensive maternity care system in the world, with some of the very worst outcomes in the developing world, which is, of course, very pitiful. And so from that study, another group was put together, a multi-stakeholder group of insurers, administrators, maternity care providers, citizens, legislators, policymakers, and they had a consensus document that took 2 years to work on, and it's called Transforming Maternity Care, a Blueprint for Action. And if you haven't had a look at that document yet, it's a critical document in terms of maternity care system, and some of the legislators are using that document as a template. For example, Representative Lucille Roy Ball Allard from California, who put out the Moms 21 Act recently, is using that particular document as a blueprint. And I wanted to also just give a plug for the midwifery model of care, because it is a community-based empowerment prevention model. It works. In the countries with the very best outcomes at birth, they use midwives as the standard of care and in many cases the pillar of the maternity care system. So there's a tremendous amount of empowerment that occurs when a woman has a relationship and is cared for by a midwife, and that translates into her life, that translates into her parenting, that translates into her sense of well-being and I can do. So I would like you to really think about the midwifery model of care, but also please look at Transforming Maternity Care, a Blueprint for Action.
Great, thanks, and thanks for those very specific comments. It does, your comments do lead me to comment on the notion of the life stages and the sort of lifespan as it relates to this strategy, because we haven't said much about that. And I think at this point anyway, we are certainly thinking that we really want to think about the full lifespan, preconception all the way up through the most, you know, senior health. So, you know, certainly your input on that is very relevant to us, but that's, I think, at present sort of the current model is to not really leave anybody behind.
Actually having
Good.
I think that's fantastic. It reminds me, as I saw this the other day, of the regional meetings that the HHS regional administrators are held. I get confused on the names of these things, but regional meetings. And I looked at the list in New York and one in Brooklyn, one in the Bronx. And it reminds me to look back at that list and make sure they're reaching out as well as possible, because that's probably our best kind of outreach that we could go out as structured so far. So that's a great point.
Well, and your comments relate not just to the building of the strategy, but its ultimate implementation, I think. And it's always, I think, a challenge, but a really important point to be made, that that kind of community engagement as this rolls out is going to be really important.
Hi, Michael Osher, Riverside County, California, Department of Public Health. You mentioned in passing about the health in the built environment. Of course, that's a big focus in California. The built environment is key. When we talk about cross-sectional, I think it's so important to talk about the planning departments and the transportation departments locally. Because as we found, decisions made 40 years ago are affecting our health today. And we need to change that built environment now, create the future to live 40 years from now. And part of that is, we're creating the healthy community element in our general plan for our county. But it doesn't affect the cities, and with the help of Dr. Eitens' group, we now have to reach out to 27 cities to make this implement. So it's one thing to talk to all people that agree with you, but for cities, they don't know yet that they want to do what we want to do. And I'm trying to be the positive creating thing. They love this when we get to them and we can offer those kind of resources. I really want to emphasize how important this is locally, the county and the city level. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
No, I think that's great, and I just want to keep reiterating specific examples on how this worked. And someone before said not just what happened, but the context that generated it. I think is really important, because how do we replicate? I mean, we have the Affordable Care Act and it creates the structure. How do we replicate that down? How do we use this? Obviously, the community transformation grants, we'll see if they're funded. It's one of the ideas, you know, to be thinking in this cross-sector work. There are so many different opportunities, but specific examples and the context within which it was generated, because there's not always a lot of money, but sometimes there's a lot of good action and a lot of good ideas. So keep them coming, please.
Good morning. My name is Sinead Boulay, and I'm the current president of the California Conference of Local Directors of Health Education. And we first want to applaud the efforts to even develop this national strategy. We appreciate it very much. We just have three things that we wanted to reiterate. The first was basically in terms of, I've heard individuals talk about implementation, involvement of individuals at the community level, local community engagement. We want to reiterate that we would appreciate the recommendation of involvement at the leadership level of generally health educators who are trained at a multi-sectoral level, multi-levels of implementation, program development, evaluation, trained in all of those areas. So recommending that there's a focus on involvement of health educators in general. And then just to reiterate the importance of local coalition involvement in terms of policy development and implementation. I think I heard it earlier before, but in terms of health and all policies and implementing these policies, it's important to have local level engagement or coalition. And then the last thing that we wanted to reiterate is the involvement of oral health, or the consideration of oral health and its direct correlation with chronic disease, with education, and a lot of other things that it's correlated with, especially with functional.
Thank you for those comments. A couple of comments have led me to think about something I don't think we've given a lot of thought to yet, which comes in the rollout of this, of how do we structure something that people can become part of a movement as this strategy comes out. How do you connect to it? How do you take leadership at the local level to become part of this movement that it's going to take to have the impact that this strategy is really a vision for, but doesn't necessarily lay out all of the paths. But I guess I would also say, in response to that comment, to please, if centrally we're not structuring your engagement, to just take it. I mean, if you're in a leadership role for health educators in an area, or for the country, or for a state, Just take it and start right now working with your group, getting them involved in the design, getting them planning about what they're going to do during the rollout. I mean, you know, I just think we're going to need 1,000 spokes, and I don't think the federal government is going to orchestrate all that for us. So these are good messages to us to say, make it as easy to get involved as you possibly can. But I guess the other message is just grab hold of the reins and run with it, because we need you to do that.
And I think that's great. And in a certain sense, part of the framework as it evolves is so that it doesn't have to be like, well, this is what everyone should do. If there's a framework and everyone says, hey, what's important to health? And if I work on this, will people, those 1,000 spokes all around the country, be working on the same things, will we get somewhere? You know, that's the piece. If you go on healthcare.gov/National Prevention Council, there's a stakeholder engagement kit. How am I doing on the plug? Am I doing okay on that one? I'm trying to work on that one. But seriously, having that input. And the other is, there are going to be people who aren't as enthusiastic as about the national prevention strategy as those of us in this room. And Jenna, you're also enthusiastic too, so you know, you're great. But there are always, so having the input, a lot of it, good supportive input, not that it has to agree with everything we say, because obviously we are pluralistic, not only society, but a pluralistic public health society. But knowing there's engagement, popularity, and a movement afoot helps the momentum generate. So having that input is just really not only valuable on the substance, but valuable on communicating to others who might not be as enthusiastic that this is important and it's popular.
I love your enthusiasm. My name is Ron Hill. I'm from New Mexico, from the New Mexico Department of Health, the Office of Community Health Partnerships. And I'd like to echo the last comments about encouraging coalitions, community coalitions, and to propose a model. But I understand that you're building a framework that's flexible, that's going to have incentives built in to accomplish those broader principles, and not necessarily specific structures and models. But we've developed a system of community health councils. We have 38 community health councils, 5 of those in tribes and the rest in counties. There are other states that have community health councils. These are non-categorical, comprehensive health councils that have representation from all sectors, from business, from schools, from providers, from consumers. And they work. They work really well in accomplishing systems-level changes and policy-level changes.
Good.
And so I guess I'd encourage you to write whatever RFPs you're going to write in such a way that provides incentives for that kind of community-based health planning and consumer engagement.
Thank you, and please drop your card off after this session, if you would. But those of you that have models that you feel are really working well, I think we'd really love to hear about that too, just so that we can engage in as much cross-sharing as we can as this, you know, moves to implementation. Maybe your model won't work perfectly, but an adaptation of it might. So I think we'd just like to have a place where we can bring up some models of how this cross-sectoral work is being done at the local and state levels, and be able to share that as part of the process.
Yeah, these are particularly in rural areas. So okay. It's a little more difficult in a large metropolitan area.
Thank you.
But that's the kind of diversity that's important. I mean, it's a big country, and there are a lot of different issues. That kind of diversity of models is critical for us to support.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Ashley Belden, and I'm a master's in public health candidate at San Francisco State. And fitness and wellness is my as somebody who deals with a chronic disease, I found that it really helps with my quality of life tremendously, and it helps me optimize my well-being overall. So anyway, what I'm interested in sort of emphasizing is that I think there's a spot for education as a major priority, and not just in youth, but all sectors of education. So in schools of planning, like who are doing graduate schools of planning, making sure that those students understand their role in the health of the public. Also, and sometimes in order to make that happen fast, I could see schools of public health playing a role in having their master's students go into those schools and do a short statement on, this is your role in the health of the public. Similarly with schools of architecture, teaching those architecture students, guess what? You have an important role in keeping our population healthy, and this is what it is. And then likewise, just in all people have a role in public health. If you've read the book Nudge, they have great ideas about how even the person who decides where to place the food at the cafeteria has a role in the decisions we make about which foods we choose. And if we can figure out how to get that information out to people in leadership roles who don't even know they're leaders, that really makes a difference. And I feel like schools of public health have a role to play in that. And finally, teaching in the curriculum of health in the youth, that this thing about the fundamental actual causes of disease and also the social determinants of health into the curriculum. So we're not just saying, this is what you can do to be healthy, but we're helping them recognize how society is actually influencing their health so that maybe we can start to help empower them to have critical thinking about how to change their environment. So those are the main points.
Excellent.
Thanks. I just want to mention, in terms of the iterative and interactive process, this strategic direction about strong public health infrastructure and the wording, you know, doesn't necessarily, it was the best we could do at the time, but we still need to think about it. It didn't come from HHS among the 17 departments. People said, we need a prevention-oriented workforce. Homeland Security said, you know, we can't do preparedness without strong public health infrastructure. They, I think, probably said the infrastructure word. Being more, and we need to build the evidence base on what works. So it really came, and the prevention-oriented workforce, it's very interesting as you say that, and I think we need to continually think about this work, this what we mean, because your point is, if everyone's trained to think about health in their activities, if you're a planner, if you're transportation, housing, education, you're thinking about what your system that you are being trained to work within, how it affects health, and how you, whatever your sub-discipline is, can promote health within it. That is really part of the infrastructure. And calling it public health infrastructure is probably, I don't know if it's off-putting, but it's not going to speak to people. And so again, the language is always so important, so that's very important. In terms of Nudge, it's very good to have Cass Sunstein in charge of regulatory policies. Really,
I'm also here from the School of Public Health, so I support that how important we all are. I'm actually here this morning from the National Coalition for LGBT Health. My name is Kelly Baker, and we're in Washington, D.C., but we're a nationwide coalition of more than 75 organizations who serve the LGBT community, and we will be making use of the stakeholder kit. Don't worry, we're all very excited. But I just wanted to say thank you for your efforts in putting this together, and just because the prevention is so important to the LGBT community, particularly because we're one of those communities where the impact of social determinants and
Yeah, good. Thank you for those comments. And you bring up a point that hasn't come up in our conversation this morning, and that is that there will be a commitment in the strategy, I'm quite sure, to strengthening the evidence base, both the practice-based evidence that comes from this kind of work and the intervention science that is needed to move to the next generation of work in these areas. So I believe we would be consistent with your recommendation until the ink is dry, of course. It's the work of the council, but it has come up repeatedly and actually was in our initial thinking that a commitment to the development of the evidence base, both through research and evaluation, is going to be a core part of the strategy. Thank you.
Good morning. Some of the comments, though, you wanted specifics. The work that we've been doing has been with low-income families with kids, doing coalitions and collaboratives and so forth. And I just wanted to share a few of the things that I think have been transformative for us.
Good.
One is on the easy, affordable choice also becoming the expected choice in low-income communities because people don't know what the other alternatives are. And so I think it's really important to key into the empowerment issue of low-income families understanding that there's a different way and a better way. But when you do that, you also have a problem of, particularly in middle-income communities, that people aren't taking advantage of the resources. And so, for example, in fruits and vegetables, we've been trying for years, but we're not getting consumption up. And so that's where we really have to go beyond education into marketing, heavy duty. And all of the merchandising and category management, all those are the kinds of things that our partners know how to do. And so I think that is a really important part of the strategy. In terms of, we have something called collaboratives, which would be a different model than what we just mentioned in New Mexico, where we're trying to cross county lines on a median market basis. Mm-hmm. And what those need are continuing technical assistance and training and cross linkages. And it needs support and skilled leadership. So the local people are providing the leadership, but they really need another level of support and help and cross-fertilization. Some of it's public relations, but it's also skillful leadership to engage communities in the projects that they want to do. So your idea of models and tools and so forth is really critical, but the menu of what works locally is really important. The last thing that nobody's brought up yet is the issue of costs. And I was really excited to see that OMB is part of your council. But what we've seen so frequently, whether it's on a local level or it's on a state level, and I'm sure on your level, is that the pricing out of prevention and the cost effectiveness of prevention, because we do require money up front. And to save money down the road. And so I think it's going to be really important to develop some models that departments of finance, where the supervisors, mm-hmm. other kinds of entities can use to justify whether it's set-asides or whether it's fee structures, whatever it have to be to support the people to do the work. And sort of a corollary to that is we talked about health literacy, but I think we need to talk about civic literacy in the sense of people want the services, but they clearly are voting down fees, they're voting down taxes. We have to do better with the resources we have, but we're not going to be able to sustain the work until, because this is new work, unless we have the ability to fund it. So whatever modeling we do with states and counties and other and cities, I think would be really important on that cost benefit.
Yeah, I really appreciate those comments and would love you also to provide the coalition model or the collaborative model. But your latest comment, I think, is really important to us. I think not that we can probably get that work done by March, but there is a reality base to this work, sort of magical thinking that all of this, obviously the new way of doing business is going to get us further, but there's a reality base to getting this work done, and it requires resources and training. And I just think we need to not only call for the tools that you're describing that can help make the case, but also be realistic and upfront in this strategy about what is going to be required to make this a reality, because otherwise it's a little bit of magical thinking here that by having the right ideas somehow they can materialize. So I very much appreciate that comment.
And let me just add, we are in tough fiscal times. It's not that people are, you know, magically saying there's no money, there's not enough money for many things people want to do in many areas, education, you know, housing and transportation. So it is difficult. So as we think about, you know, the policy base, as we increase our evidence base and cost effectiveness and figure that out, think about policies that aren't upfront budgetary costs, but obviously, I mean, look at what we've done in this country with tobacco-free, you know, smoke-free air acts and the impact it's had on health. You know, there are certain things that are really policy-based and beneficial. And the other thing is we have to also turn back and look at ourselves and say, hold on, what are we doing that might not have as strong evidence that how we can transfer? And it's a very challenging thing, whether we're in a nonprofit or a government, every good idea and good program has a constituency and has benefits, and always trying to think about how to balance our resources for the highest value added is a real challenge, but it's one of the things, if we lead with that, we have more moral power to say, hold on, we should be doing this. Look what we're doing. It's a tough one, but I think it's the right issue, and it's a challenging one we all have to keep working on.
Hi, my name is Dave Golden, and I have an unusual job. I'm called the Director of Public Health at the University of Minnesota, but my population is the students. I work at a college health service, and we've got roughly 40 to 50,000 students on our campus. Last year was great. All of a sudden, campuses across the country realized, wow, our health services are kind of like a public health office because of H1N1. That was a really swell epidemic, nice one to have. But it was sort of a wake-up call to a lot of health services. And to you, I think of us as the low-hanging fruit that's out there. We feed them. There's 15 million students enrolled in post-secondary education right now. That's more than's enrolled in secondary education right now. We feed them, we house them, we insure them, we have clinics at these places, and I think have a big role to play in prevention and wellness. Every campus that's serving food should just have calories out where their food is, ready for their purchase. Every campus should be tobacco-free. There should not be a puff of tobacco allowed on a campus outdoors. All campuses receive federal funding through loans, whether you're private or public. And so really, we had Dr. Eichmann at our campus this year who had just a profound effect on the people that were there in terms of our role. So it's great to be here. It's really cool to be around all these brilliant people that are doing great stuff. I'd like to see more of my colleagues from college health here. A lot of you guys went to school. Give them a call. Make sure the campuses are smoke free and we're getting, let's get to them. And thank you.
I just expect the alumni rallying call for donations.
My name is Ralph Lovelace Young, at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. I work technically for the Johns Hopkins Center for the Future, but I'm the director of the Johns Hopkins Healthy Monday Project. So what we do is we try to do these campaigns, programs, and then we test them and we try to get some data that you're asking for. But right now, Wellpoint Insurance gives $100,000 to go to their clients to create these programs and make free, learn, you know, some interesting stuff. But I've been But I think the important thing is to say this is a health is a right. And if you're able to get people to say, to you have to go to them, unfortunately, the former TV producers, I think of go-to moms and the power brokers of everything. And so you say, why is it that the country's allowed to make food that makes your kids unhealthy? Why is it that we've set up the whole, our whole system of bad public transportation, the way our schools are set up, we're not providing enough. We don't find that the infrastructure is important enough for your health because companies need to make more money. How do you want to do it? But you have to say, let's take some money from on the medicine side and put it towards public health. We can't keep saying we're a cost. We're going to save you money. No, we're actually saying we're going to improve your well-being and we want a right to everybody and we need to make it that this should be a huge priority in all health.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Our boss likes to say that public health starts with the premise that people are better alive than dead.
Good morning. I'm John Clymer with the Directors of Health Promotion and Education and the Alliance to Make U.S. Healthiest. Two quick points. First one related to making healthy choices the affordable and easy choices. I would suggest that our goal should be to make healthy choices the default choices, and certainly the work we just heard about on college campuses is a great way to do that. This should be about changing norms or setting new social norms that support and encourage health, and so affordable and accessible easy choices are a pathway toward that goal rather than goals themselves. The second point is simply to underscore what Janet said about involving and engaging the private sector. There's huge leverage there that goes far beyond anything that we ourselves can marshal, even embracing or bringing together 17 different federal departments and all the state and community agencies. Quick illustration of that, it was on a recent plane where I sat next to a guy who was a sales executive with Genio Turkey Company. And it turned out that after he made his sales call, his next big challenge was to school up on the requirements and the guidelines that have been put out by the Alliance to Make or the Alliance for a Healthier Generation, the Heart Association, Clinton Foundation Collaborative, because Sodexo, one of the monster institutional food service companies that's in a lot of our school systems, is requiring that all of its vendors meet those Alliance guidelines for better health or healthier products. And so I think that's a great illustration of both systems change and abetted by policy, but it's the private sector initiative that created the tool that policymakers then could use to drive the systems change. And much of it is being cascaded out through the private sector. There's huge leverage there. So I'm glad you made that point, and I think it would bear a little more emphasis in the report and the presentations.
Makes sense. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Ida Kanduslai. I'm the manager of the Chronic Disease and Injury Prevention Unit in San Mateo County Local Health Department in California. I am also co-chair of the Bay Area Regional Health Inequities Initiative in the San Francisco Bay Area. There are a couple points that I wanted to make. The first one is around one of the goals that I mentioned earlier and repeated here, and that is to promote health equity. And here it's worded as eliminating health disparities. And in promoting health equity, it implies that we have health inequity. And that means that we may be unfairly advantaging certain communities in the work that we do. And when we say that we're going to focus our dollars on evidence-based approaches, my challenge to you is, how are we going to create health equity if in our research we have disadvantaged certain communities that we did not do research on, and now we are only going to fund communities for whom research exists? How do we establish research for those communities that don't have research? And it's really frustrating to go after a request for proposal in an organization, and then they tell you around evidence-based and what that means. And for your community, it doesn't exist, therefore you don't even bother applying. So I would really challenge you to think about how you might build more health equity into the actual structure that we have, because we have structures that create health inequity. And then the second comment that I have is around the spectrum of prevention. The California Tobacco Control Program has been hugely successful in 20 plus years because it has used the spectrum of prevention. That meant that we started off by educating individuals who mobilized communities, who built coalitions, who advocated and demanded policies to happen. So policies happen in California, not because the state passed them, but in local cities we passed them. And it wasn't health department people who passed them, they were actual constituencies. When the city council and said, we need you to pass this because of X, Y, and Z, and if you don't, here's what's going to happen. That is what I see also missing in the approaches here, because we seem to have a focus on policy and environment. And in California, where we've done a fantastic job in social norm changes in the past 20 years, and we've lowered our tobacco use rates, we're now at the level where we have low-income communities of color with low education. We know exactly who they are in most of our communities in California. They have smoking rates at the 30% level, when the rest of California is closer to 10%. Why is that? We have structurally built a health inequity in the fantastic work that we've done. Another area where focusing on policy and environmental change may not work is in California, when we funded corner liquor stores to be able to buy refrigeration units so that they can sell healthy fruits and vegetables. But nobody talked to the community about the fact that these stores were now going to be selling fresh fruits and vegetables. Well, the community didn't go to go buy fresh fruits and vegetables. And then the store owners felt, well, this is a failed attempt because we had fresh fruits and vegetables and nobody bought them. It's because nobody did community building, nobody educated people, so the people didn't come. So I would just really encourage us to really think about how we can be more inclusive and really be serious about the term health equity when we do this work.
Thank you, thank you.
No, and I want to say in the status report, we talked about where the evidence base doesn't exist, we should build it, but I think you put such a better fine point on it, because it's not just things about obesity, which we don't know what to do with, but we really structure bias at times into our funding and our programs. That's an excellent point. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Seema Hassan, and I'm a certified public health professional, and my passion is tobacco control. And I'd like for you to ensure that you have measures to anticipate and tackle any changes that the industry makes, like it's shifting from smoking tobacco to smokeless tobacco. And that would be, have huge implications for oral, for mouth cancer and stuff like that. So I'd just like for you to have measures to control that.
It's an excellent point, and why we focus on tobacco rather than smoking as we move on. Thank you very much.
My name is David Slee. I'm from the Injury Center at CDC. And I want to thank you for adding injury-free living to your strategic directions. It's the leading cause of death at age 44 in this country. I want to make sure that injury-free living includes violence as well. And my second suggestion is you may want to consider including the U.S. Department of the Interior as one of your federal agencies. We document that about 213,000 ER visits for injuries occur every year on public lands. Half of those are under age 24.
Thanks. Two excellent suggestions.
Hi, my name is Heidi Gullett. I'm a physician trained in family medicine and preventive medicine. So for the last 6.5 years, I've worked in community health centers, and so I come to you with that focus. And I've been really struggling because I look at my patients both as the person in front of me, but also the population for whom I live in the community mm-hmm. with. Mm-hmm. And I see the high impact of quality preventive services, and I'm someone who pushes those immensely. But when I'm in the exam room with a patient, it's very difficult to do that when they have the inability to cope with the chaotic lives around us, and our parents, colleagues, and citizens around us don't have the resources to really focus on the things that affect them every day. The son that's using heroin, or the fact that their home is foreclosed and they're living in a shelter for the first time in their lives, the fact that placement. Mm-hmm. And I think whoever is in charge of implementing the workforce primary care issue, it's going to be really important to have a very specific strategy for addressing that, because I don't think we're going to get to the preventive services that are now available to people without cost sharing until we address the primary care issue. So I think that's really important. The other thing that I've really struggled with for so many years is, why are my patients not able to cope with their lives? And I've come so far back to parenting as a very fundamental piece of this, and the mental and emotional well-being may be part of that. But so many of us in therapists were not trained to teach people how to raise children and deal with stress and those sort of things. So I just think if some specific focus on emotional well-being part, that would be really fabulous, because when it starts with children, if the mom is functional and the mom is able to deal with her life, the children learn those behaviors so much easier. So those are just some reflections of things that I have struggled with, and I hope that we can include as a prevention strategy. Thank you for your work. It's a shot in the arm.
Thank you for your comments.
Hello, it's Carl Muller with the Campaign for Public Health and the CBA Foundation. I just want to kind of not comment. Obviously, I work in D.C., and my goal is to try and get federal funding support for these initiatives. And I just want to kind of, with that vision, put this into, or encourage you to try and make this as policy and political proof as possible. And I think that, you know, there's a huge connection here that when this gets rolled out, if it's not beautiful, perfect, exciting, and well written, then it's going to be put in the hands of other folks who are going to pick it apart and use it for sound bites. And it's listed alphabetically, which is unfortunate, I think, because that puts active lifestyles first. And even in the detailed table on the inside, it talks about, you know, transportation networks that promote bicycling and walking, which the LA Times story not too long ago of Senator Enzi railed against this entire prevention of wellness fund as being for bike paths and you know, jungle gyms. I think we have to keep in mind when this does get released, there's a political environment it's going to fall into, and it has to connect very well. And I think just to write these in a way, you know, the rationale, most people don't get sufficient physical activity, okay, but add facts in there that nobody can, you know, pick apart and say, you know, it's been shown that moderate changes can reverse this or improve lifestyle. So keep the process going. I heard this first at ASTO. I think it's so commendable that you're traveling around the country to do this. I commend your work. Just, you know, in a fine print, make sure that we can beat you guys up.
Thanks for that low bar. You know, there are so many great comments. It's great to be among so many practitioners and professionals with great comments. But I think I just challenge you all to join us and our colleagues on how challenging this will be to write the all things for all people well. So I appreciate your input and your patience.
Try to make everybody happy, because that's impossible.
There you go.
You should let them know when I'll take these three comments.
Okay, so the three folks that have patiently stood with us here, we'll take your comments and then wrap up the session.
Thanks very much. Good morning. My name is Francesca Martin. I'm a consultant in areas of housing and behavioral health treatment. I think that the Affordable Care Act and this Prevention Council presents unique opportunities to really operationalize the connection between housing and healthcare. Something I just wanted to offer a couple of thoughts on. One, at a systems level, one in terms of language. I want to highlight the work of the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness, which has been newly reinvigorated over the past 18 months, and for the first time ever has produced a comprehensive federal plan with defined benchmarks, target outcomes, and goals to address the challenges of long-term homelessness. And that plan is actually being operationalized and having a direct and substantive impact already state and local levels in terms of resource management and programmatic decision making. So I think that might be an important body of work to begin to align with more directly. Also, I want to highlight that HUD for the first time has been funding preventive work, both through the ARRA stimulus funding, but also through the renewal of the HEARTH Act, which for the first time is funding homeless prevention activities. So as we talk about prevention, we've got prevention in a housing setting. Again, it seems like a very natural
Yeah, good comments. I would just comment that HUD has been one of our most engaged, active, participatory agencies at the table. So I think very consistent with probably your recommendations here today.
And they weren't in the legislation, and there, as an addition, was critical.
Interesting.
Those interventions, and nothing wrong with those interventions, they work, but there's other things that we need to put in place now to make sure that we're not leaving folks out and we're not impacted in a negative way. That's what we're trying to do.
Very good, very good. Thank you.
Different visions of the word integrative, how I keep hearing again and again. In terms of the fact is, there are team approaches to care, which you've all heard about in the healthcare system, but this is a much larger version of what the team approach, and it's a societal team approach. We've talked about the environment, but obviously we've talked about the link between clinical and community services, and two, you know, handy fancy words that belie all that's underneath them on the clinical side in terms of physician extenders, in terms of PAs and nurse practitioners and all that, and the community services, which are a diverse set within diverse institutions. And getting those linkages is critical on an operational basis. With electronic health records provides more opportunity. So I think it's really critical to figure out how those systems link together. I don't think that prevention strategy does, you know, everything in all elements to try to tease that map out, but I think it's very important that those systems of care really work together.
And we'll give Dr. Benjamin the last word, but thank you so much for your attendance. This was just tremendous input to the plan, enormously helpful. We couldn't have hoped for anything better than this morning, so thank you very much.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
Well, great. We've had almost 2 good hours of a real conversation. And let me just say the next step. So obviously, there's an opportunity to continue to provide input into the plan. And we encourage you to go back and do that and engage in your own organizations, get consensus, move things forward. Obviously, this will be a very complex document when it's done. And then obviously, when it comes out, read it. And then we'll improve upon it over the years. It'll never be perfect the first time out, but it'll be good to go. And here's the website, of course, to go to. But also there's some other things you can do. I think obviously on the advocacy front, it's very important that you begin to talk to policymakers now, to educate those policymakers on the importance of prevention and wellness, particularly the prevention fund, what that prevention fund is doing in your communities. I was talking to some reporters the other day, and I made several points. Point number one was that this is not about government. This is about local organizations trying to improve the health of their communities. This is about engaging the YMCA and parks and recreation and the local housing environment. And those groups are all being funded through this Prevention and Wellness Fund. It's also about building a strong public health infrastructure. And that's also being funded out of the public health fund. It's about workforce, which is being funded out of the public health fund. And even though a little controversial, actually the primary care workforce effort was funded initially out of the public health fund. So this fund, although I happen to think jungle gyms in inner city communities are a heck of a lot better investment than jails and police and other things, but that just happens to be me from from a guy from the inner city. But I don't think we should be afraid of defending those positions. After all, the members of Congress have those in their communities. They have jungle gyms in their communities. They have very nice schools in their communities. They work in a city which has communities in which don't have those so nice stuff, and they haven't done much to support that either. So I think that we have a role we can play in terms of educating our policymakers, educating our family members. I really believe strongly of the importance of the unanticipated messenger. I mean, imagine the power of having the head of GE come in fighting for the prevention fund or IBM and talking about the importance of the fact that if we don't change community norms, that we're not going to have healthy communities for those folks to put their businesses in. So I pointed that out to the reporters that, listen, healthy communities are very important to business. Workforce wellness programs are very important to business. So we need to think in a much more cohesive way. We need to be very, very proactive in trying to promote this, to engage communities, to get the faith-based community involved in a more assertive way, to ask on the front end of our communities about what they want as part of this. And I know there's going to be a very proactive community strategy once this program comes out, again, to try to make sure that the average citizen understands the things, that the many, many, many things that they can do. So this is not only about individual responsibility for yourselves about what you can do, but also your individual responsibility to make sure your community is safe, effective, and a healthy community. So with that, I want to thank you very much for spending your time with us at this very, very early morning. And please enjoy the rest of the meeting.
Thank you.